Hello, my name is Steve Wiggins, and this is podcast number 14 of the Sects and Violence in the Ancient World blog. Today's topic is going to be Bible translation. My wife showed me on Sunday an editorial in the local paper by Leonard Pitts Jr., that is. Leonard Pitts's commentary is always insightful and entertaining to read. I noticed, though, that this particular article dealt with a topic that I feel very closely related to, and that is the idea of Bible translation. Specifically, he begins by discussing the alternative Wikipedia. It is called Conservapedia, and it is being sponsored slash written by Andrew Schlafly, the son of Phyllis Schlafly, the social conservative commentator that has been in the news for many decades now. Of course, as you might expect, something in this genre is that it is intended to be a neocon, if you will, alternative to liberal education, citing the fact that Wikipedia is liberal in its bias, even though it is indeed open to editing by anybody who is willing to take the time to do it, at least anybody who's willing to take the time and do it seriously. The Conservapedia is intended to be in the service of those who would rather have an alternative version of the facts, and this is what Leonard Pitts was writing about. The specific topic, though, that caught my interest was that he was talking about the Conservative Bible Project, or writing about the Conservative Bible Project. And as I read through the page on Conservapedia about this project, I became more and more concerned about what its goals and ultimate agenda really is. In a nutshell, we can say that the ideas represented by Schlafly, and in a good neocon fashion, basically present progress as being a bad thing. If we see progress as moving us towards new directions in learning, clearly, if you believe that all that was ever needful for people to know was revealed back in the turn of the era, somewhere in the first century of the Common Era, then progress beyond that really is not necessarily a good thing. Indeed, it is a bad thing because it challenges the conventions of the first century. Now, we don't see people like Schlafly standing in line advocating for first-century healthcare, and we don't see people in the neocon camp asking for new pieces of parchment or papyrus to type their blogs and web pages on. But it does seem that in their selective kind of sense of progress being bad, that they've targeted specifically religious progress as being bad. Now, the idea of making a Bible in one's own image is not a new one, and as I mentioned in a blog post that I wrote earlier today, there are indeed people who have done it many times before. Probably the most famous one is the Jefferson Bible. Thomas Jefferson is well known for having taken a New Testament and having removed the miracles from it so that it was a naturalistic document. He also removed the references to Jesus as a divinity from the New Testament and came up with a moral book that was a kind of a philosophy or a theology that was intended to be moral but not distinctly, shall we say, Christian in the sense that it believes in Jesus as the Son of God. Now, this Jefferson Bible, of course, is the one that is presented to members of Congress and such when they are elected. It is a Bible that is intended to demonstrate the progress of the Enlightenment that was all the rage back in the late 1700s, early 1800s, when Jefferson was active. Another example of this was, of course, Elizabeth Cady Stanton and her work on the Woman's Bible. The Woman's Bible was published around 1895 with the intent of removing some of the more obviously sexist material from the Bible. Those passages that portrayed women in a negative light she tried with her team of commentators to remove some of the more negative aspects of that and make it a more even experience of reading the Bible for women. Now, both of these projects clearly had an agenda as well. They were trying to even out the perceived excesses of the Bible, whether they be political or, if you will, fantastical, in the sense that they promote a supernatural view of the world, something that Jefferson was eager to get away from. Now, what Schlafly is doing is not too dissimilar from that, in the sense that he is also trying to promote a Bible with an agenda, translated by an agenda. And indeed, Bible translators realize that they are translating for an audience. Anyone who is serious about Bible translation needs to learn the original languages firsthand and presumably can read the text in the original languages with a fair degree of understanding. Otherwise, what's going on is not translation, but paraphrase. So I'm giving the benefit of the doubt to Mr. Schlafly and believing that he has gone back to study the Hebrew and Greek and Aramaic that he needs to have in order to make an accurate translation. Now, once you've done this homework of learning the languages, the translations obviously are meant to go to a certain audience. Bible selling is big business. Publishers know that if you can get a good-selling Bible, you're set for life. It's no accident that publishers like Oxford University Press, which publishes many Bibles, could basically support its entire operation probably on the sales of Bibles alone. And Thomas Nelson, another publisher that thrives on Bible publication. So people love to have Bibles that they can publish because people will buy them. Now, what concerns me about what Schlafly is doing is that, unlike Stanton or Jefferson, what his intention is to hold progress back or to move it backwards, to take things back in another direction. And so there's a kind of a sinister undertone here, because the Bible today in neocon circles is used as a tool. It's a tool for bludgeoning others. Those who are against your way of looking at things can be beaten with the Bible. And those in the consumer market who are not very familiar with Bible translation and what it's about, or the way that it's done, are often easily convinced that anybody who claims to be an expert in Bible can translate just as well as anybody else, and that is simply just not the case. So a Bible that is used to privilege those who are working against progress, in my mind, seems to be a bit problematic. So without further ado, I'd like to take a quick look at the tenets that Schlafly publishes on his Conservapedia page as those which are the operating principles for his conservative Bible project. These are not something that I'm making up. I'm simply taking them directly from his website. The first one is that there's a framework against liberal bias, providing a strong framework that enables a thought-for-thought translation without corruption by liberal bias. Well, there's a problem with this immediately, and that is that translation is not really a thought-for-thought process. It's a much more complex process than that. And no matter what your bias is, any translator approaching the material should translate it or approach it objectively, intending to translate perhaps to reflect their audience, their readership, whoever's taking a look at their material. But they don't approach it with a bias intending to show that the liberal or conservative way is better. For example, those who translate the Bible that I know of, the people that are colleagues of mine, do not go into it with a liberal agenda in mind and saying, I'm going to show just how liberal the Bible can be. They try to translate it as literally as possible and try and make sense of that in today's world. The second of his 10 principles is not emasculated, avoiding unisex, gender-inclusive language and other modern emasculation of Christianity. Well, again, translators do not approach the Bible intending to make Jesus into a woman or trying to remove, obviously, gender-specific material that is intended in the first century or before to be gender-specific. What has happened is, of course, our viewpoint has changed over the centuries, and now we understand it in quite a different way than we used to. His third principle is that it should be not dumbed down. Not dumbing down to the reading level or diluting the intellectual force and logic of Christianity, the NIV, New International Version, is written only at the seventh grade level. So this is an adult version of the Bible. This is, I think, a criticism aimed mostly at things such as, or translations such as, the Good News Bible or the NIV, both of which were intended for younger readerships but are often used by adults. The problem with it, of course, is that Bible literacy is assumed here, which doesn't really exist in the general populace. Principle number four is to utilize powerful conservative terms, using powerful new conservative terms to capture better the original intent. Defective translations use the word comrade three times as often as volunteer. Similarly, updating words that could have had a change in meaning, such as word, peace, and miracle. Now, this one really bothers me because we are now entering into the heart of the matter, which is that words do not have meanings. They have usages. And what we're seeing here is the suggestion that even the very basic words of peace and miracle and the word itself are being claimed to mean something different to the original writers than they mean to us today. If we have no basis of a common language, it's impossible to discuss the matter at all with any kind of intelligence. So what we're doing here is trying to set the terms so that only those who agree with the translators are involved in the discussion. Principle number five is to combat harmful addiction, combating addiction by using modern terms for it, such as gamble rather than cast lots, using modern political terms such as register rather than enroll for a census. Well, okay, we can give them that, I guess. It's, again, intended towards the social good and probably is not too far out of line with regular translation practices. Number six, accept the logic of hell. Applying logic with its full force and effect, as in not denying or downplaying the very real existence of hell or the devil. Again, reading the Bible with a bias towards the literalness of certain passages is a bit problematic. Not just a bit problematic, it's very problematic. And assuming that that is what is going on, it basically is putting the cart before the horse in translation terms. So it would be like saying that we have to assume the veracity of every single aspect of the Bible, which I'm sure that Schlafly would enjoy, before you can even be allowed to approach it for translation, in which case we would have no translation of any ancient documents that was unbiased. So I think that really, again, is a problematic precept. Number seven, express free market principles, explaining the numerous economic parables with their full free market meaning. This clearly pandering to the neocon movement and the prosperity gospel. And the word that I would like to use for it, I will not use since this may be listened to by younger audiences, is simply out of character completely with the New Testament or the Christian scriptures. Jesus' parables are not free market material. Principle number eight is exclude later inserted inauthentic passages, excluding the interpolated passages that liberals commonly put their own spin on, such as the adulteress story. Well, the story of Jesus and the adulteress has been questioned by biblical scholars. It clearly is a piece that is floating out of context. And there are many literal translations that try to leave it out as well, simply because it doesn't have a place in the authentic reconstructed gospels as we have them. The difference here is that liberal scholars do not leave out passages just because they don't like them. They leave them out only if there is good reason for it. And excluding inauthentic passages just because you think they're inauthentic is not adequate reason for a translator. Principle number nine, credit open-mindedness of disciples. Crediting open-mindedness often found in youngsters like the eyewitnesses Mark and John, the authors of two of the Gospels. Again, we don't know who the authors of the Gospels were. Mark and John are pseudonyms in a sense, in that we don't know who these people really were, and we cannot simply say that they were eyewitnesses. If you read their two Gospels side by side, you'll see they tell very different stories. And finally, number 10, prefer consciousness over liberal conciseness over liberal wordiness. Preferring conciseness to the liberal style of high word-to-substance ratio, avoid compound negatives and unnecessary ambiguities. Prefer a concise, consistent use of the word Lord rather than Jehovah or Yahweh or Lord God. Again, in reading the details here of this statement, we find the preference for Lord, a neocon phrase that is much preferred. I've noticed that in conversations with conservatives throughout my entire life. They prefer to use the word Lord instead of God, and tend to overlook the fact that the word Lord has very strong connotations. Again, for their point of view, understanding the lordship of Jesus Christ and that sort of thing is the clear idea behind it. Well, I look at all these ideas for the Conservative Bible Project, and I say, I don't think we really need another Bible along those lines. It sort of scares me a little bit to think that all we have now, all that we need now, is groups of people out there making up their own Bibles or making up their own translation principles, and using this Bible, which is a completely fictitious document that they've concocted, and using it against people who don't know any better and saying that this is what the gospel really says. If this sort of thing continues apace, I really fear for the future of our society as a whole, and not just for liberal scholarship, but for any kind of truthfulness in visiting history or historical documents at all.